Hello, Bitvaulters. This is a slightly special episode in that it will have relatively little to no relevance for a lot of our listeners and a lot of relevance for a geographically select group of you. If you don't live and work in an area of Australia where paralysis tick is a problem, then the only reason for you to listen to this one is to listen to some really smart people talk about a really complicated and interesting problem. And maybe also as a wake-up call to make you realize that we need to sometimes take an informed look at the things we do and the stories that we tell each other about why we do it. And to make us realize that we don't always know as much as we think about some of those things. Basically, it's a lesson in holding onto your beliefs a little bit less tightly. But if you've never treated a tick case in your life and you don't think that you ever will, then feel free to skip this one and listen to some music, or even sit alone with your thoughts for a bit. But if you are in a paralysis tick area, then you'll be well aware of the current shortage of tick anti-serum. And to put a timestamp on this, I'm recording this introduction on the 19th of November, 2022. And you very likely have some questions like, how do we ensure that we still do the best for our patients? Where our previous dose rates for TAS comes from? And why it's suddenly okay for us to use less? And whether you'll be in trouble with the vet boards if you deviate from the label dose in response to the shortage? I know I certainly have those questions and many more. So we've done what we do. We've gathered some of the smartest people on the topic and we pick their brains. The smart people in question are all members of the Tick Paralysis Advisory Panel, which is a group of veterinary and scientific experts who convene to review the latest scientific information regarding the prevention and management of tick paralysis to provide guidance and recommendations to vets and pet owners, i.e. to you and your clients. We've got a link to the most recent guidelines in our show description for you if you want to check them out, although these are pre the shortage, so we might adjust some of those based on this conversation right here. Here's the thing. As you'll hear from this conversation, even the smartest veterinary and scientific experts have some shortages in hard data when it comes to this topic, purely because there's still a lot that we don't know for certain about tick paralysis. So what that means is that some of what you'll hear here will be opinion. Very well informed opinion, but still opinion. So if you're listening to this thinking that you're about to get the last word on exactly what we should be doing, not going to happen. What it does provide, though, is some incredibly useful food for thought and feedback from some of the people who've spent vast amounts of time on the front lines with this condition and have done the bulk of the research that has informed us on what we do know. So you'll be able to make your own informed and defendable decisions. So who are our panelists? We'll just do a quick summary because if I read each of their bios in full, then this episode will be an extra hour at least just to get through the bios. First off, we've got the original gangsters of everything tick in southeast Queensland, the godfathers of TAS, Professor Rick Atwell and Dr. Terry King. Both of them had been in practice since the late 1970s and have treated more tick cases than you can imagine in your worst nightmares. Both of them have played key roles in research and education over the past few decades at the University of Queensland and in private specialty practice, and they've contributed greatly to their respective fields of medicine for Prof. Rick and emergency and critical care for Dr. Terry. Professor Rick's research has focused heavily on paralysis ticks, and he has published more than 200 papers and received numerous veterinary awards. Dr. Heather Russell is an emergency vet and the clinical manager at Northside Emergency Vet in Sydney and has been a member of the Australia Tick Paralysis Advisory Panel since 2016. She's on the floor every tick season trying hard to find better ways to save these patients, and she joins us to tell us what they're currently doing with their tick patients and how they'll be changing what they do. And then we've got Dr. Rob. Dr. Rob Webster is a specialist in veterinary emergency medicine and critical care and a founding partner of Animal Emergency Australia, or AES to their clients and referring vets. They're a group of emergency vet hospitals with the vision to create the future of emergency medicine and critical care, and also the company where I do my clinical work at the moment and where I bump into tick patients as part of the annual onslaught of tick patients that AES treats every year. Rob continues to work as an emergency veterinarian and is heavily involved in teaching and research in the field of ECC. Rob's greatest achievement, however, is probably the fact that he's also a regular contributor on the VetVault clinical podcasts on the emergency and critical care stream. One of Rob's dreams is to see tick paralysis eliminated as a cause of death of dogs and cats in Australia. Just a quick plug here for AEA's incredible online information resource, Vetipedia, where you can find a wealth of info on everything ECC. It's kind of like having a really smart friend who you can call at 2 a.m. when you get that case that you really just need some help with, but all your mates are sleeping and you feel too bad to wake up Rob. You can find it at vetipedia.com.au. That's vetipedia.com.au. And it's free. The link will be in the show description. Okay. Tick paralysis, TAS doses, what's new, how to save them, how to adapt to the changes while staying friends with the vet board. Let's do it. So Heather, how are you guys looking with your stock?
Pretty low at the moment. I'm a little worried. We're down to 19 bottles at last count. I ran the figures and last year we went through about 2 liters in the next 2 months. So unless we get a supply soon, we're going to be in trouble, I think. Yeah, I think in practice, we're seeing shortages and that's quite unnerving.
I think it's a really hard thing to look at something you've done for so long and just accept it as normal. Mm. And then all of a sudden you've got to make some decision. And yet from my point of view, there is enough data out there to say that we can use lower doses. I think there's a challenge now because you have to change the dose and that's a huge change for people to absorb, I think. Mm. And they're scared about the vet surgeon's ward as well.
And I hope you were recording already there, Hugh, because that was the big question that everyone's going to ask in practice. If I use a lower dose, well, A, am I doing the right thing by my patient? And B, is Terry coming to get me? And he looks really gentle and peaceful there, but he's pretty ferocious when he's tracking down veterinary malpractice.
I got a pretty big noose in the back pocket. Yeah, it's vet boards, and certainly Queensland vet board is just concerned that contemporary practice is followed. And, you know, there's lots, isn't there? Heather brought up that one of the manufacturers suggests that you use dexamethasone as a pre-medicant, actually suggests dexamethasone and an antihistamine. And while that is on his label, there is pretty good evidence, very good evidence out to show that those things do not prevent anaphylaxis. So you would find that veterinary boards would take note, you wouldn't get into trouble because you use the stuff because it's a label use. But having said that, you wouldn't get into trouble for not using the stuff because there's very, very clever evidence to show that you don't need to. So I think all of those things are taken into account. You know, I visited a practice yesterday and he had a little sign on his door that just said, we are likely to be experiencing shortages of tick anti-serum. And when I talked to the practice owner, he said that they had enough for 4 large dogs left and said, we will be likely, if this continues, we'll be likely not to be able to treat your dog and we'll have to try and find somewhere that does have anti-serum. And if everybody runs out, well, of course, there's nothing that can be done.
I feel strongly about this. There's enough data out there to say we use too much TAS. And we find it very hard to change our point of view. And it's very frustrating because I can't express, think of writing a letter to the ABJ trying to put all the doses, et cetera, together.
Yeah, I get you. But you also find that, you know, even in your paper, the mean dose of dogs that didn't recover was as high as the mean dose of dogs that did recover.
You're exactly right. That says that if TAS was a key thing, those dogs would have more TAS. If you go 2x the dose up front, there should be more survival, but there's not. And the reason is that they die of respiratory failure, come lung disease. They don't die of a lack of TAS. And on the basis of that, at Manly Road, we've had a couple of meetings now. And we've convinced the vets to use 0.2 mils per kilo and 3 mils per dog, depending which is the higher. And I do believe we've convinced them of it. I mean, it's very hard to tell young vets how to scratch their nose because they know it all. And yet we're able to get it across because we presented data that sort of seems to support that view. And the other thing is we've got to look at the studies of other toxins that effectively are exactly the same as tick toxicity. The other thing is Andrew couldn't find the toxin in the blood, and that makes a lot of sense because most of these very tiny toxins leave the circulation very quickly. And we've got to think of toxin supply rate and tissue transit time and then rate of binding. But if you do all that, it just makes a complete story that has no contradictions in it. Now, I'm coming from a biased point of view, but I've also had a lot of time to read through all this stuff, and I think we're on the right track. I firmly believe we don't need to use as much as we do.
Should we start with that just to help us understand the fight that we have with the toxin? What do we know, or what do we think we know about the tick toxin? How much does a tick produce? Does it keep producing the longer it sits on there? Where does it bind? What does it do? I don't know who that question is for. What do we understand about the toxin?
I can answer some of that, but based on what we've done. I mean, the toxin is very small. The tick secretes, then sucks, then rests. And this is a nice example how to explain tick size has no bearing on the outcome, because it is determined by the toxin supply rate. So if you've got an old tick, it's not going to suck and secrete and rest. The cycle for that will be a lot longer. Whereas you've got a young, healthy tick, they tend to suck and cycle much faster. And that's why you get severe disease and progression of disease quite quickly. And if you think back to what we called the hot seasons, you found that dogs were deteriorating much more quickly than normal. And that was simply because of the toxin supply rate. But once it gets out of circulation, TAS can't do a thing. And there's a very nice study. There's a 41-page review of botulism. And the reason I rave on about botulism is because they have the data, but we don't have it for our toxin. And they're very similar. And when they didn't use intensive care, which obviously a lot of people are trained in that to a very high level now, when they didn't use intensive care, all they had was an anti-serum, and the mortality rate was 70%. But once they could support their patients, the mortality rate was 5%, and that was without anti-serum. And the explanation of that is the toxin is not very long in circulation. That's why I think we only need a small amount of TAS to mop things up. And after that, the dog is then dying of respiratory disease.
Was that botulism in dogs?
It's in dogs and people, but mainly people where they've measured the toxin. The reason they have problems with anti-serum and botulism is they usually take a couple of days to make the diagnosis because it's such a rare disease. So it takes a while to make the diagnosis, and then they find the anti-serum is too late because the patient's already got clinical disease and the antitoxin can't chase the toxin. And I think we also forget about the size of things. I mean, a neuromuscular junction is like 5 nanometers wide. That's sort of like a 5 in a billionth of a meter, or 10 to the minus 9. So we're dealing with incredible small things, and yet anti-serum is in comparatively very large. And as I understand it, it can't escape the vascular tree, as can the toxin. So we've got a toxin that can escape very quickly and bind and produce signs. And when you think about it, if that's right, when you think about it, the best time to use TAS is just before they develop signs. Because if you've got signs, you have to have bound toxin, which means that anti-sera is not going to change that. It's only going to stop new toxin leaving the circulation. The problem we have, we can't see the toxin, and we don't know exactly what is in the TAS. Okay, they say it's above 500, but what does that actually mean in terms of antitoxic effect? And I don't think that's been recorded.
So, Hugh, could I jump in with just a couple of follow-up questions for Rick? For people out there in practice treating tick paralysis, like Heather's team and the emergency vets all around the country, you were talking about resting and feeding cycles and when this toxin is excreted, Rick. Is it still right to say that no toxin is likely excreted in the first, 2 days of feeding, and then there's a rapid amount of toxin produced after that as the salivary glands hypertrophy? Or how does that happen? Because we certainly see a significant delay from tick attachment.
Yeah. Well, if you look at how ticks work, they take 3 days to upregulate everything because they've been sitting on a bush for a year maybe, and all their systems are shut down. So they need 3 days to upregulate. And if you look at the original work of Jan Ilkhuis and also of Clooney's Ross, the dogs typically got sick on day 4 and they sort of died on day 5. And Jan Ilkhuis was the same, except it was a delay. And the reason for that is all the dogs I happened to visit her at that time, and all the dogs were in the basement at the University of Sydney, which is a very cold environment. So whenever you've got cold ticks, they don't secrete and suck as fast. And the same thing with old ticks. At the end of the season, you'll find that the ticks aren't as toxic because they're in a deteriorated state. Now, we did experiments, and I think the figure is something like 16,000 ticks on five trials of 32 dogs and 10 loadings of 10 ticks per dog. And on that, no dog developed any signs of tick toxicity up to 72 hours.
But and for people out there, because I've always had this impression of tick paralysis being a slowly progressive disease, and we haven't treated our tick patients with the same urgency that we might treat a patient that's just come in with a snake bite. What you're saying, just to paraphrase, is that although there's a delay in onset of paralysis after the tick attaches and feeds, and it's at least 72 hours, as soon as there is any clinical signs, that's when we want the tick off and the antitoxin in right at that moment. So no delay, you know, expedite the treatment of these patients right to the front of your ability in your hospital.
Yeah, I think the first thing is to take off the tick. Obviously, that's the supply of tetoxin. In that paper, that prospective study of 588, and we're dealing with black and white things like life and death, in that study, once again, just going back to Clooney's Rice original work, the very best data out of that paper is the fact that plucking ticks gives the best results. So and this goes against all the stuff that comes out of Sydney with regard to meat allergy and everything. If you squeeze a tick and remove it, you do not secrete toxin. It's impossible. The way the tick architecture inside the tick, it's impossible for pressure to be applied to the salivary glands and secrete. And you're thinking about, we're probably dealing with an eighth of a mil over 20 over the period of attachment. So it's an incredibly small amount of toxin. That's what I was saying before, it's so tiny compared to the anti-serum. I know volume comparisons aren't necessarily real, but it's so small compared to the amount of anti-serum we got. And it's so tiny, it gets through vessels very easily. And once you've got signs, it means TIS doesn't work against the toxin causing the signs because it's now bound. And to bind, it actually has to go inside the neuronal cell. So it's got to get inside the cell. And then we don't know what happens after that, but it causes a vesiculopathy, if you like. There's five ways to destroy a vesicle. And obviously botulism does one, and probably our toxin will do some other. But effectively, it stops the OCHCF secretion. So if you've got clinical signs, you've got to have bound toxin, which means TIS can't work. It can't track there, and it's already bound. So when it gets inside the cell, this is botulism now, it has a long chain to break into the cell and then a short chain, which then upsets the proteins around the vesicle. And it's all protein interactions. And it's ultra-microscopy at 10 to the minus 9. So, I mean, we've got to sort of, in spite of having to be practical, we've also got to think about the reality. You know, we're dealing with incredibly small amounts of toxin.
Can I just jump in there? When we come back to label doses of ticks, so I've got the AVSL dose in front of me on the label. We're looking at what they say is, as a guide, a dose of 1 mL/kg live weight of AVSL Ixodes holocyclus antivenom should be taken as that dose required to effectively counter a 1A to 2B paralysis produced by one tick in a susceptible animal. So to me, that's, and then it goes on to say doses as high as 4 mL/kg may be required in severely affected patients. So that's going against what you're saying, Rick,
I agree with what you're saying, but there is no data. There is no data to support that. Nick clearly said the other day it was empirical. And if I can go back 52 years, I was working at a practice in Toowong. Doug Cummings was the name of the vet. There were only about 10 vets in Brisbane then. If he had a tick case, he simply went to a farm and bled the farm dogs and then brought it back, separated, and then gave a dose. I mean, there was no dose with that. There's no proof that it was going to work. There is no data to support the dose rate. There is no data at all. And if you only need 5 mils and you're giving 15 mils, you get the same result. But in our mind, we're trapped by this high dose. And there's no other anti-serum in the world that's done is dosed on a weight basis.
Yeah, that was my question. I was going to say, why do we care about the size of the animal? Because with snakes,
we
care about the size of the snake, not about the weight of the dog. Is there a reason for it? Anybody in the theory? Anyone? Or was it just...
I guess that comes from traditionally on volume of distribution of your anti-serum. You wouldn't give the same dose to a 50-kilo greyhound of propofol that you would to a 4-kilo cat, because the volume of distribution wouldn't anaesthetise your dog. So it all comes back to that. That's where that's traditionally done.
Okay, so it's not so much about the number of antibodies in the vial. It's about a big enough volume to make sure it actually gets to where it needs to go.
Well, the spread of those antibodies. So, yes, if you gave, say, 1,000 antibodies IgG to a Great Dane, you'd expect it to have 50 antibodies per kilo circulating around somewhere, whereas if you gave the same to a cat, the volume of distribution would be a lot higher. And I can see Rick, but that's where it all comes from.
Terry, it's just I'm trying to project the truth a little bit. If that was the case, why isn't botulism and tetanus and all these other things in people? Why do they just dose a set like 2 mils per vial or something like that? They don't worry about the size of the patient, whether it's a child or an adult. So if you give an injection in something, within 7 seconds, it's all over the body. It's in the brain, it's everywhere, because the circulation mixes things so quickly. And the TAS is just so big compared to the toxin. So you've just got to imagine a huge vacuum going through the blood, sucking up the toxin. And there's not a lot of toxin there, as Andrew was saying the other day. He clearly said, I've looked for toxin, I've never found it, except in the urine. So it says toxin gets out of the circulation quickly. If it's in the urine, it is out of circulation. And if it's in the uromuscular junction, the same thing is out of circulation.
I don't think Terry was saying that that's necessarily the way we have to dose anti-serum, but more the background around why we might be using a mil per kilo dose for this thing, Rick. Not necessarily saying it's... rational, like, where are you, Terry?
See, it's very hard to break a tradition, isn't it? Like, we've done this forever, and we feel if we don't do it, you know, we'll get into trouble. Now, look, I don't know how persuasive I am, but Manly Road are using 0.2 and 0.3 as of last week. And okay, you say, oh, have any dogs died? Well, no dogs have died, but that doesn't prove a thing. Obviously, they've got to have a severe case and then give it TAS and find it die and then blame the TAS dose. But dogs are dying all the time. And Rob, I think, would agree it's 5 to 10%, depending on what paper you read or what group of dogs you've got. And to prove that, like, if you've only got 5% death, to prove an advantage, you've got to do a lot of dogs with different dose rates because the mortality rate's so low. And I don't know if anyone's done that experiment. Yeah, because you could do 0.5 and 0.25 and 1 mil and see if the results are the same. And I'd bet pounds of peanuts they would be the same.
But this is a study that we need to do, isn't it? Because we've got some observational evidence that challenges the status quo, and we've got some interesting parallels that you've highlighted with botulism, but we don't have controlled dose studies on dogs in using this naturally occurring disease. And they will be difficult because, as we all know, most of these patients, especially the dogs, die of respiratory failure, you know, pulmonary parenchymal disease, not as a result of their paralysis. So it'll be a challenging study, and that's why it's not been done. But I think we need it to be able to use that level of confidence for vets about dosage. I know we've reduced our dosages, but if I asked our guys to drop it down to 0.2 mils per kilo, I don't know what your guys would say, Heather, but I think the AS vets would just nod their head and do what they'd been doing.
The other complexity, and it's a very confusing issue, the other thing is we don't know exactly the protective level of IgG in different batches of TAS. So even doing that experiment, we could well have different amounts of IgG in the two different groups, if you like, if you know what I mean, because we know it's above 500, but we don't know how far it is. And therefore, two batches may have different antibody levels. So that's another complication when you're doing a dose study like that.
Heather, what are you guys using, or what have you been using?
We've just been using our standard doses. So we've been using up to 25 mils in a dog and 10 mils of non-purified TAS in a cat and 5 mils of purified. But our order only came in yesterday. I know we were talking about this a bit off air before, but we ordered 40 bottles of TAS and received 2. So for us, that's really concerning. Looking forward, when we're going to need about 2 liters moving forward over the next couple of months. So for us, we are looking at doing pretty substantial dose decreases as a result. And I think as long as there is published data, which we do have, to support those lower doses, then I think like this is the time and the opportunity for us to challenge the status quo. So,
well, I think we've got no choice. If the shortage is truth, how can you justify treating one dog at, say, you know, 1 mil, and then the next 5 cases you've got to treat at 0.1 because you don't have enough Sizaira? I mean, it's not, you know, from a fairness point of view, that's not fair. Well, those 5 dogs should have the same dose.
So the 10 mils that we used to use for cats, because, Rob, that's what at AS our protocol was, not 10 mils of non-purified TAS for a standard cat. But then a lot of GPs I speak to in the area, they've been using 5 mils for a long time for cats. And they're like, yeah, why do you guys use 10? Where's that even from?
Yeah, we've always used TAS to excess. There's never been any limitation to the TAS. And it's gone from one of the most expensive parts of treatment to one of the cheapest, and also one of the key determinants of survival. So what we've always done is used 1 mL/kg per dog, or 20 mils. And in cats, we've used 10 mils. In our revised protocol for this year, we've dropped our dosage for cats down to 5 mils, or 5 mils of the purified TAS. We've not split those vials because there's no preservative in them. And so it would be an infection risk to administer them on different days. And so 5 mils of raw TAS or 5 mils of PTAS for a cat. And in dogs, we're using 1 mL/kg with a minimum dose of 5 mils and a maximum dose of 15 mils. And so we've really significantly dropped the dosage of dogs. Nothing near as much as what Rick and the guys at Manly Road have done yet. But from our calculations, that will get us through this period at least until the middle of December. So fingers crossed so far.
Yeah, I think the other point is that you've used 1 mL/kg forever. And that, I guess in essence, it doesn't matter how much you give. But the question now is how little can we give and not run out of TAS? I mean, there's no big deal if it's 1.5, et cetera, et cetera. All I'm saying is I believe we don't need near as much as we use, but there's nothing to stop us using 2 mL/kg. My response would be it's not going to improve the dog. If you've got a severe case, it's severe because the toxin is all bound. And even if you give a second dose of TAS the next day, the mortality is the same. That doesn't change it. And as Terry said to start with, there's over 1,000 dogs that we've followed where we knew the dose. So forget about all the other subjective things. We knew the dose, and the dose of survivors and non-survivors is the same. Now, if TAS was critically important in those bad cases, those dead dogs would have had much less TAS, and that's why they died. But TAS is not the key factor. The key factor is how much toxin and how much paralysis you get, plus lung, etc. In other words, the 4D sort of cases. The more bound, the more severe it is. The less bound, the less severe. But there's no big deal. I mean, all we're doing is trying to get the lowest effective dose because we've got a supply problem. We're not trying to convert the world. If you want to use 5 mL/kg, go ahead.
And we will generate some new data here too.
We need data all the time. We need data because otherwise we're just, you know, we're telling tales.
So to me, there's two components to this. The one is, A, as always, we want to save patients. And for most practices, we want to keep them off the ventilators. And I want to figure out practically how to do that. The other component is going to be the legalities, which we'll come back to in a second, Terry. But first of all, just to try and save those patients or keep them off the ventilators as much as possible. So I want to recap what you've said about the tick and how this works, because this is really interesting. So, Rick, am I understanding correctly? So tick attaches, sits there for 3 days to switch on the machinery, so to speak, before it starts becoming dangerous.
Yeah, then exactly.
Then it will sporadically inject rest. And it's injecting tiny amount of toxin that goes into circulation for a relatively brief period of time and then binds. And then once it binds, nothing we can do about that dose that it's injected. It's the next
exactly, right.
It's the next little dose that we're trying to address with the TAS.
Mm.
So the key things here for trying to save them is to get that tick, as you said, to get that tick off there. So we stop it pushing more venom in, because once that venom's in, it's going to escape us basically relatively soon.
Well, in that 588 study, the dogs that had their ticks plucked immediately, and plucked means squeezing and all those other things that people have spoken about, oh, it's going to make the dog worse. Well, the dog that has a disease that is progressive, so no matter what you do to it, you scratch it behind the ear, it's still going to get worse because the disease is progressive. In those dogs, those 16,000 ticks, I mean, we had 10 ticks per dog, and we'd take them off at 72 hours. Now, those dogs had no signs at all. None of the dogs got toxic as far as clinical observation is concerned. So we know there's a period where they're not secreting enough toxin to produce disease. And by day 4 and day 5, if you look at the data, dogs die at day 5 or day 8 if you're in a very cold environment. Ticks on cold days, they don't load properly. They will not load.
Okay. So climatic conditions, so heat is not so much to do with how many ticks are out and about. It's to do with how excitable those ticks are, how hard they're working. So then we've got our injecting our little bits of toxin into the bloodstream. So our TAS is really there to mop up whatever hasn't gone through it. So you get your tick off, so you remove the source, get your TAS in quickly, Rob. That's what we're learning. Get it in, because we don't know how much of that toxin is still circulating in that interim. So you want to get it in there really quickly. How long are we talking? Do we know how long it hangs around for?
No one can find it in the circulation.
Well, if you can't find it, it means it's either very small or it's not there. And if it's in the urine, which I think Andrew said that, I might be wrong on that, but he said something about toxin and urine. If it's in the urine, it means it's gone out of circulation. So TAS can't affect it.
So it's a rapid treatment, really. The how much TAS is the big question. Some TAS sounds like the answer is to go and mop up what is still there. And then once that ship has sailed, it's sailed. And then we're stuck with what we've got. And then it is about critical care to keep them going.
Exactly right. Critical care is the answer. Yeah.
And Rob, critical care has come so far. Heather, you know, I'm sure you would have seen the same thing over the last 10 years or so in emergency. In the old days, we couldn't even keep up with the number of patients we were treating. You know, just to give them the TAS was hard enough. But now we're much better as veterinary intensive care facilities at recognizing respiratory failure early and treating it aggressively. And I think that's something that we should, you know, try and communicate today, is that that is paramount to a successful outcome in these patients. They're all much sicker than they look. Is a safe assumption.
Yeah, they definitely do often go downhill very quickly. And certainly, I know Ellie mentioned at our meeting that you guys are seeing a bout of tick cases come through where they're presenting as 1As and then rapidly deteriorating and needing ventilation. And that's something we're appreciating in Sydney as well. So I think you have to assume and warn owners that they can all head south and that they can all be quite unpredictable.
So talk to us, Heather, about recognizing and what do we do about it? A, when they deteriorate like that, so Rob, from your research and what you guys are seeing, Heather, is that aspiration? Is that when we start shifting from can't breathe because I'm paralyzed to I can't breathe because I've got pneumonia happening?
Aspiration's a game changer, and just one single vomit can really change the outcome of a case, or regurgitation, I should say. So I think it's really important to have these patients monitored, if possible, round the clock, because often these things will happen overnight in clinics when there's no one there. So yeah, absolutely, we're seeing pneumonia as being the leading cause of death in these patients. So
what do we do about it? Because as you say, we monitor them, like where I am, we watch them like hawks, and then we go, oh shit.
Yeah,
Well,
early support. So things like oxygen therapy. So we're using a lot of nasal oxygen in these patients. Early antibiotics as well. So I know Rob's done a study that's proven early antibiotics will change outcomes. So we do escalate to antibiotics. We're doing a lot of veterinary point of care ultrasound looking at lungs this season. We're actually doing a study in that in this clinic at the moment. Yeah, so early antibiotics, advanced care, if they are regurgitating a lot, offering intubation and ventilation to protect airways early on rather than leaving it like leaving a dog sitting there regurgitating for days on end, actually protecting that airway actively, all of those things are what we're working towards in our clinic.
I'm interested in the ultrasound, Heather. Is that for research purposes, or are you actually using it to make decisions?
Well, a bit of both.
You're looking for bee lines, and
yeah,
what are you looking for? And
it's a bit of both. We're looking at the study's looking at whether it changes our treatment. So we're making an assessment in what we would do, whether the patient's going to get a standard treatment, and then a study is happening where they're performing an ultrasound and then filling out a questionnaire as to has this changed what we're going to do. And we are finding that we are changing treatments. It's very early days in the research, so I'm not going to make any statements about it at the moment. But yeah, more antibiotics are being used, I'd say, as a result of the study.
Help us with that, because we're stuck in that period of we're saying, okay, we should all use fewer antibiotics. But it sounds like with ticks, we should not dilly-dally.
Yeah.
When is the trigger? When do you go, all right, I'm starting on antibiotics. And then when we start, what are we using?
So any animal on oxygen is getting antibiotics with us. Any patient that's persistently regurgitating and not on intubation, we would start on antibiotics as well. And also using our VPOCUS findings, whether that will also help escalate if we're seeing shred signs, if we're seeing B-lines, starting antibiotics in those patients too.
And which antibiotics are you using?
We're using IV clav. I know that differs to what Rob's using. And then for ventilated cases, we use PIP/TAZ on those ones. Is that what you use, Rob?
If we had IV clav, that would be an excellent choice. But we're using generally a broad spectrum penicillin, so IV ampicillin or cefazolin on these patients, but much, much earlier. So what we'll do is when we see obstructive breathing, there's got to be some degree of pulmonary parenchymal disease. The tick paralysis itself doesn't cause obstructive breathing, so we're using that as a point of care ultrasound, as a point at which you might investigate further. And ideally we'd say take chest x-rays, but that's not always the case. At the very minimum, start antibiotics. Once those patients are intubated and on ventilators, then we're generally amending that protocol, the antibiotic use, depending on culture and sensitivity. But I really wanted to hear from Terry about the vet surgeons board. And so I thought, you know, maybe we could move to Terry and find out what things are we doing to get complaints to the vet surgeons board outside of tick dosage? Because has the dosage ever come up, Terry?
No. Well, certainly not in my time, and I've also done a bit of a straw poll around some previous board members, and none of them remember any time that a dose has come up. Now, it may come up if this shortage does come out, but I would doubt it. It's more where a person like you asked for an opinion on a case being handled would be on how that case has been handled clinically, and boards just expect veterinarians to act as to what would be expected in the veterinary community. And the bit about offer for referral, absolutely. So, for example, if you had a veterinarian in west of Birdsville, a veterinarian there would not be expected to be able to ventilate a patient. But as long as steps were taken and there was what's called informed consent, whereas a vet in southeast Queensland, for example, would be expected to offer referral. Even the person out in the bush would say it might take you 6 hours to get in, but you'd be better off going into a 24-hour centre. And as long as the client understands that or is told that, and it really is helpful if you document that that occurred, well, then it's informed consent as to you and the owner made a decision on what was the next part to in treatment of that dog. The complaints that have come up, and there have been quite a number in my short time on the board over a year, where the complaints have been on a missed tick, so the dog has gone on and died and another tick has been found, and the other one was not treating the dog early enough. Like I turned up at 4 PM, my dog was paralysed or getting wonky. They said, take it home and come back if it gets worse, or by the next day it's very much worse and goes on and dies. So to me, the things we've been really trying to get out to our practitioners is, if you think it's a tick, strongly consider treating it for a tick. And secondly, the minimum standards that you guys came up with for tick search is, as long as that's documented that there's been a tick search, because we know from Rick's experience is just how difficult these things are to find. Even experienced people can miss them. So boards are very much saying you're not expected to find 100% of ticks 100% of the time, but you are expected to search for ticks 100% of the time.
Okay. So to recap, Terry, to keep us out of trouble, and it fits with the also trying to save the patients most effectively. So when they come in, offer TAS if there's a tick. Don't go, I don't know if it's clinical. Let's see if we can avoid treatment. Go home and watch. So say, yep, there's a tick. Your patient is at risk. And then listening to what Rick said, it sounds like, well, that is really probably the ideal period to treat, is to go, well, there's a tick. There might be some toxin in there. Give it some TAS.
Yeah, the best time to use TIS is just before they develop clinical signs in theory.
So we offer TAS and then they say, yeah, let's treat. And then we're going to say next step, we're always worried about the second tick. So advise that you're going to do a tick clip if it's appropriate, unless it's a very short-haired staffy or something, tick clip it so that you can say to the board, yes, we did everything within our power to try and find that second tick that caused the deterioration of this animal. So treat early, shave them. If they don't look great, offer referral, if possible at all. But then back to the purpose of this recording, back to the dose again. So in the past, dose hasn't been an issue with the board, probably because we all just used kind of standard doses, right? Now, if we're at a point where people are going to start getting creative with doses, what is a safe dose? Let's say somebody listens to this and goes, hey, I like what Rick says. I'm going to use Rick's dose. Is that going to get you in trouble potentially? Even if it makes clinically sense, can there be a question mark around that where the board might say, well, that's Rick's going out on a limb with that and we're not sure about that? Or is it fine, you gave some TAS, it makes sense, there's data to back it, and it's defendable?
Yeah, I think as long as you argue the case why. Say, for example, that there doesn't end up being an anti-serum shortage at all, You might have to explain a little bit more why you chose the very low dose rate.
Okay.
And you would quote those papers, of course, and I would be very surprised if that would not be accepted, that you decided on that and you said to the client, the manufacturer says this, we've got a very big shortage and we've got some very experienced people that believe that we don't need to give as much as what we did, and I'm afraid that's what we've got to give, then I would say, don't see a problem. The client could make the decision, perhaps, that they might ring the guy next door and see if they've got more. And I can see where all this is going. It's not always in the patient's best interest to be moving him around all the time.
Yeah.
But you would have to make that informed decision with the client, I believe.
So we do you recommend discussing the change of dose with our clients? Is it something where we go, look, we never told the clients how much TAS we're giving anyway. So yes. Are we going to just...
No, we never have.
So are we going to say to our... Should we be saying to our clients, hey, there is this situation... Because of that, we are giving less than we used to.
Yes.
Are you okay with that, or just you have no choice? That's what we're doing. Does that not open the door up for complaints? If something goes wrong, then they're going to say, "Well, they gave less, and that's why my dog died." Should we just?
Yes, that's a decision you've got to make, isn't it? Will that cause a problem with the client by saying it? But if it was my client, I'd say absolutely yes, because I believe I could inform most of my clients along the way. Now, it's a very difficult time, and I know what's happened, particularly at nights and weekends when emergency centres are overrun, that you've got to sit down and have another discussion again on the dock. But if there's any condition that causes problems associated with vets and their clients, it's tick paralysis. So I think it's got to be part of your long discussion with every single tick case.
Heather, what are you guys doing? Are you going to tell people?
Yeah, well, this opens it up, doesn't it, really? It is a really challenging position to find yourself in as a vet working in emergency clinics particularly. I know the majority of our clientele won't be happy with getting a reduced dose. They want their dose, their full dose for their pet that's in front of them. We can call round to other emergencies.
It's all entitlement.
Yeah. So it really does put us in an awkward position. I've advised my vets to do like a gentle dose reduction that we don't have to discuss with the owners, more in line with what Rob's doing. And I think that it's defendable. If I'm going to the board, I'm taking Rit with me to argue.
I keep thinking, Heather, we have this recording. People can just send this link to this podcast to the board and say, well, listen to this. This is why I did what I did.
Yeah, look, that's the difficulty being in this tick advisory panel, that you're making these recommendations and we don't all have the data. So I think the published studies that we've got will support lower doses, and we just have to reduce our dose. And I think it's a really difficult discussion. As a vet, I rang the New South Wales Vet Practitioners Board, and they said, you know, as a vet, you can use an off-label dosage. So my understanding was that as long as you could defend it, it was reasonable to do that without telling the client that you're giving them potentially, in their view, a suboptimal treatment, really. Mm. But I could be wrong, Terry. I'm not sure. You probably have got more knowledge around that than...
No. You would never get into trouble from the Queensland Veterinary Surgeons Board in that regard because of the way you've just said it. I would suggest, and if it was me, and I treated tick paralysis dogs for 45 years, but I'd be being gentle with my dampening down of the dose purely because of my historical usage of the stuff. And I'd take on board everything that we've talked about, but I'd be trying to be a little bit gentler with the dropping off. And that's just me. Rick's idea with Manly Road sounds wonderful to me, and it'll be great to see how their year goes with that too. And I know that won't mean 100%, but it'll be a pretty good guide for my money for next time. And I'm fervently hoping that we don't have to do this for much or if at all. And we'll go back to where we were going, back to the label use. And absolutely, a label use means that you can't get into trouble on that dose, or would be very difficult to get into trouble. But look at how much label use there is and how much evidence has come out of label use. Different drugs. Look at trilastine, for example. The label use is 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram once a day. There's absolutely irrefutable evidence out in the veterinary literature now to show that 1 mg per keg BID, so somewhere between a third and a half the label dose, is more effective. So totally, it's a drug, not an anti-serum. I'm just using a drug. Omeprazole, label use, 1 mg per keg SID. Very good veterinary literature to show that you need to give it twice a day for it to be effective. Now, it's an off-label use in dogs anyway, but the label use tends to not get you into trouble. But you can argue off-label uses all the time in the world.
Heather, see, in Queensland, we have a lovely, supportive veterinary surgeons board, a better climate, and I mentioned there are lots of awesome positions for emergency veterinarians up here as well. So,
Rob. You know,
and we've got about 70 bottles of tick serum.
Oh, dear. That's very, very lovely. But I hope none of the New South Wales emergency vets are listening. So I hope they come to our practice.
There's definitely an emotional component to this, because I'm quite happy with the dose reductions. And especially when I listen to Rick and I go, well, logically, that makes a lot of sense to me. And then I thought, but what's going to happen if my dog accidentally, let's say we slip up on my beloved billy dog's Revecto 1 month and he ends up at the hospital? Am I going to be brave enough to go and reduce dose for him, or is he going to get the full whack? And it's just that habit of
what psychology, right?
Rob, are we missing anything?
No, I don't think so. I was going to put my 2 cents in on client discussions in that in our group, yes, we're definitely not mandating that vets talk to clients. What we're doing is coming up with the most effective strategy that we can use. And if we need to defend that strategy, we will. But because of the complexity of the number of clients and the number of different veterinarians and the really heightened level of stress in emergency at midnight, the chance that we can regulate those discussions is really low. It's more likely, we believe, that we're going to trigger more complaints by having those discussions at the time. Because as soon as something goes wrong, which 9 out of 10 times is going to be pneumonia or client running out of money, it's going to come back to, we gave a lower dose of tick anti-serum than was recommended. And the client will have a reason they can point at that something went wrong. So our group has reached a decision to what we believe we can support for veterinarians using, and then we'll support that wherever we have to take it. hats off to Terry, though. I'm sure, Terry, you can communicate that effectively to every client you see. But I just think we've got too much complexity there.
Yeah, I get you. I get you. The trouble. Yeah, I think that's a reasonable way to go, because what would happen, for example, if that went to the Veterinary Surgeons Board, a complaint about your treatment, and it was picked up that you gave 0.01 mil per kilo of anti-serum, the Veterinary Board would probably want an outside opinion on that to say whether or not that, so they would send it out usually to eminent veterinarians. So we would be likely to send it to Heather Russell and ask her if she would be willing to provide an opinion on that, on the way that animal was treated. And if she agreed to it, and then that opinion would be fairly weighted upon in the board's deliberations. And we, also being Queensland too, we have an awful lot of history of knowing of Rick Atwell's work, Rick and others' work, to show that we can see that there's an enormous variation. So, yeah, I absolutely get you that you wouldn't bring that up as part of the client discussion. The ones that are very important, I think, is whether you want to give tick serum or not, whether you want to clip the dog and keep searching or not, and secondly, where you're going to go next with your treatment. Are you happy with the fact that we may be going to ventilation, or we may want to intubate your dog, all of those sorts of things? They're more important in our view.
That's super helpful. Thank you, Terry. All right. I think it's probably time that we start wrapping this up. We could talk about this forever. It's really, really interesting. Thank you, everybody, for your time. You know, there's a saying that says, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. I think I'm all right in this room. Rob, thank you for pulling this together. I'll get it out there soon. Thank you for all your input. If you like learning on the go through the magical medium of podcasts, and you like our format of questions to and insights from people at the top of their game, then you should check out our clinical podcast at vvn.supercast.com. The easiest way to stay up to date, get your CPD done, and even get a bit of inspiration for your work week. We have a free 2-week trial to try before you buy, and we do also offer practice subscription. Contact us at vetvaultpodcast@gmail.com to find out more.